Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey, this is Steve O'Brien, President of Talent Solutions with Job.com.
Steve, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Very excited about this conversation. Dive a little bit deeper into your role with Job.com. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Thumbnail version. So I became a recruiter by accident, and then I stayed on purpose, and have been here for about 20 years in various ways and capacities.
Well, that's exciting. And you've been with Job.com for how long now?
2 years.
Okay, that's awesome. So yeah. Tell us a little bit more about your current role with Job.com and maybe shine a little bit more light about what the company is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I get to do a really fun job. I do a lot of identification of mid-sized staffing firms that we're going to buy. And then integrating them and helping them grow in the Job.com ecosystem. So it's a ton of fun going out and meeting, in North America, there's 20,000 mid-sized staffing firms. And so there's plenty to go explore. And I spend a lot of time getting to know entrepreneurs and founders that have created really cool businesses. And then a small number of them are the right ones for us to acquire. So we get to put together deals and make those offers and bring them into what I think is a pretty awesome company, and then help them grow within Job.com. As an organization, we have three focuses. One is an advertising business that has a lot of fairly traditional elements to the job board industry and space. We're looking to do a great job acquiring and building relationships with an audience, right, of job seekers. The second thing that we focus on is technology and recruitment process automation. We have a product coming out I won't name yet, but I am excited to be able to talk more publicly about that. That's doing some pretty slick stuff to bring automation to recruiters. And then the third, which is the group I manage, is our staffing portfolio, right? So these are the firms that we acquire and bring in and help grow.
Well, that sounds super exciting. And thanks for a little bit of that background. What the company is all about sounds like a lot of different pillars and directions in just the world of staffing and recruiting, yeah. Which resonates on so many levels with us building the technology at MyBasePay. It's a fascinating world. It's ever changing. And I'm sure you've been on that side of the spectrum where you analyze the companies for potential acquisition, merger, or whatever other structures are. You probably, one of your priorities is to stay ahead of the curve in terms of the trends and where the industry is just shaping to go. So share with us any of these insights or trends that you are researching on a daily basis where you think will shape the kind of the state of the current industry.
Yeah. So I'll tell you about three. One that's probably on a lot of folks' minds, and I'll just sort of encourage you, if it is on your mind, that this is a good thing to be thinking about. One that I don't know we're doing a lot of talking about in the industry. And then the last one is one that I think is kind of unique to Job.com. So the first thing that we're spending a lot of time developing and making sure that we've got great user experiences designed for is asynchronous communication and interactions on process steps that don't really require influence or recruiters and candidates to necessarily sync up, right? And so you don't need to be on the phone with somebody to schedule an interview, right, necessarily. And so being able to have that occur asynchronously is nice. When you apply for a job and you're going through some of the basic qualification, you might, work a second shift, or maybe you get off work at, 8 o'clock at night, and you'd like to know, what are the basic screening questions that you're curious about from my background? You don't need to talk to a recruiter for that. And you don't need to talk to a recruiter during the day for that, right? You should be able to do that asynchronously. And so a lot of that automation or just rules-based stuff, we're building in there. The second thing that we're doing that probably is on some of your minds, but I don't know how many systems are doing it at the moment, is trying to move away from telling recruiters that we know something is or isn't a match. The truth is, from an automation and matching perspective, we don't really know. But we have an idea, we have some suspicions. And so a lot of the user experience that we're designing for recruiters is more in the direction of suggestion and interaction as opposed to declaration, right? And we might say that we think this candidate is interesting. Do you agree, right? And through those interactions, we allow machine learning loops to be built into the software so that over time, maybe one day we can say we know something's a match. But right now, we want to learn and suggest. And then the third thing that I think is unique to job.com is we're building a lot of data visualizations into the way that recruiters consume data and the interface within our automation software. So we all, you know, are merely mortal. I think that's partly our superpower as well as one of the things that, you know, burdens us with realities like imperfect recall, right? Like if you've ever had one of those things, like you remember a candidate and you remember fragments of the candidate, right? Like I remember they worked for eBay. And I remember that they were in Arizona, but that's all you kind of remember, right? Job.com data visualization tools help you take those memory fragments and actually uncover the conversation and the candidate, but to do it naturally and rapidly as opposed to having to go like rifling through your email.
Well, that blows my mind because it resonates on so many levels with some of the technologies that, you know, I'm very passionate about, starting from that self-service, you know, solutions that really allow for to minimize that interaction, the day-to-day, what you've talked about, mm-hmm. that can really be streamlined through automation, through algorithms, and basically looking at the data and the behavior of the users and basically build a solution that will kind of cater to that. Yeah. Those are very exciting trends. And I'm sure we can talk about that for the rest of the podcast episode. But yeah. I want to move on a little bit further. When I've interviewed your our mutual friend, your chief visionary officer, yeah. Aaron Stewart, on the podcast a few months ago, one of the concepts that he talked about, which resonated with our audience on so many levels, is that war on retention. Yeah. Which is the next layer with war for talent has been real out there for the last, you know, year or so. With market just being in such a tremendous shape, share with us what are some of the trends that you're observing in the companies as you analyze. You've mentioned mid-size staffing firms. How are they adapting to the current conditions? And what are some of the things that more successful staffing companies are doing that really allows them to be, you know, stay ahead of the curve?
Yeah. So it might be interesting as we talk about retention and what companies are doing that's innovative is to share with you a point of view on how historically we've looked at retention and some of the pressures in the industry, because it affects the way that I assess some of the interesting trends now. So here's a, you know, Steve's armchair point of view on major trends in retention. So back, you know, my dad's worked for the same company for, you know, 115 years, right? I mean, he's an old man. He's had a great career. But I mean, he's worked for one company his whole life. And his recommendation to me when I was younger was, you know, go find a Packard Bell, right? Go find an AT&T and, you know, just like get stuck in and climb the ranks, right? None of us that are currently navigating modern careers think that that is really how things work anymore. But at the same time, back when those were the true expectations of a career, you also had other things like pensions, for example, right? And so if you went in and you put 40 years into a company, there was an interesting sort of post-career financial relationship. The whole employee-employer dynamic was different back then. Somewhere in the 80s, the percentage of companies that were launching or managing pensions had peaked and started to decline. And in the early 90s, we started asking ourselves, well, if we're not making these major financial commitments, how do we get people to stay? Right? It's a very practical level, right? Like now they feel like they need to take care of themselves in a way that they didn't when we had these pensions. And the academic literature in IO psychology started to begin poking in these terms, employee engagement, right? And so I'm the one that is suggesting that employee engagement is a sort of a predecessor to pension, but I really think that there's a linkage between, okay, well, they're not staying because of the pension. How do we get them to stay because of the purpose or the engagement? And this led to, you know, probably 15 to 20 years of trying to manage and construct what does employee engagement mean and what does it drive? Well, one of the things that it drives is discretionary effort. And that's a pretty stable outcome of research within employee engagement is engaged employees work harder and are more willing to give extra time and effort, right? It's pretty intuitive, but it also shows up in the research. Well, with discretionary effort also, ironically, comes increased expectations, right? What do you want when you do better at your job? Recognition, money, promotion, advancement opportunities. And so this created a follow-on problem to employee engagement, which is, okay, if we engage our employees, we do get discretionary effort. They do become more sticky, but they also want more, right? Which leads to some of the modern trends in retention that I think are super interesting is looking at retention as career management and mobility, and not just like, hey, do you love the company? Or let me give you a cool swag bag. That matters, right? I don't want to diminish little things like a boss that sends you a $25 gift card to show you that he cares. Like, that's nice. And we want that. But we also want to know, how am I going to navigate my career and the balance between my concrete contributions and my curiosities and desire to explore? The companies that are really understanding those needs and designing processes, internal mobility programs, and bringing together talent management and talent acquisition to enable employees to have that experience within the four walls of their company, they're increasing retention. There's a lot of value when you figure that out as well. Average tenure within a company, if you're under the age of 35, is under 2 years, right? If you can figure out how to get people to stay, there's a big reward for companies to get that right.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you on the engagement side of the equation. And I've had my great share of bad and great leaders when I was in the corporate environment, and those that really helped me grow and those have really been instrumental in my success. I've noticed one pattern, that they are genuinely interested, invested in your success as an individual, as a professional. And they continuously, you know, it's an ongoing conversation from a standpoint of where do you want to go? Where do you want to grow? And let me help you get there. And in the process, help me with what, you know, what I need, I guess, your strengths to contribute to my teams. And I'm a strong believer in that, in the sense that it can't be just, you know, on the surface for you just to be in a one-on-one meeting with your employee and just ask, okay, what are some of your goals? There's got to be a path. There's got to be a career ladder in terms of where is it that your teammates want to go.
Yeah. This is a revolution in my mind as well, John, in leadership and leadership philosophy. So I've had two major experiences that have transformatively changed the way I look at leadership and my role with my staff. Many of us have probably gone through these if you have employees, because I do think they're typical patterns. When I first became a manager, what I did, and some of you listening may be able to relate to this, is I thought management was externalizing to all of my staff my internal monologue. Right? The way I talk to myself, now I'm going to talk to other people. And right. Then you realize, well, you're not other people. And that's a probably terrible strategy. Like, you know, if you're a pretty aggressive type A person and you're talking to somebody that doesn't relate to that language, well, you know, that's not what makes you great at scale. That's just incidentally the way that you talk to yourself. And so you need to learn to sort of understand what are the drivers and the love languages, so to speak, but what are the ways that my staff listen and receive information and then assemble their own motivation? So that's sort of the first one, but then that builds and becomes the second one, which is some of the great leaders have exhibited this learning that you described. The second one is realizing that once I become a good manager and I develop great teams, I don't get to keep them forever. And I made that mistake, right? Like, I thought that I'm building a great team so that they're mine, right? And like, you know, like Gollum, you know, my precious, you know, like I've got these staff that don't let me down and now they're mine. And then you realize, well, that's not good either. And like this last frontier is, okay, it's not about the way that I talk to myself. It's about the needs of my team. And then once I develop them into a great team, it's not about keeping them. It's about sending them, right? And understanding where do they want to go? And when you do that sort of like abdication, right? Like you just keep stepping back from talking to your staff the way you talk to yourself, or thinking that you get to keep them. Great culture blooms, right? Great teams bloom, right? Like things work that much better and retention happens.
Totally. I see that, you know, at organizations of so many levels on daily basis where, you know, companies are striving to build and foster that culture, whatever the culture is, and they struggle because they throw these perks, they throw these programs at employees that, you know, on the surface seems like you do some type of investment into your, you know, your workforce. But in reality, in my experience, when I had succeeded building high-performing teams, one of the main and only ingredients is really being fully vested into their personal growth and where is it that they want to go. And you're absolutely right. Having that mentality that the team will not stay with you forever, you know, it's flawed and it's going to get you in trouble, whatever the case may be. Yeah. Which brings me to the next point that I would like to discuss with you, which is also fascinating yet very challenging. And I'm talking about interviewing. Yeah. A lot of folks, you know, they under pressure, they're very good at interviewing, but it's from my personal experience, I noticed that a lot of interviews are flawed because a lot of that is based on your past personal experience.
Yeah.
And you focus a lot on what are the weaknesses that I can tolerate in that candidate versus what are the strengths missing on my team, and structuring the conversation, not so much in an interview as a two-way street. Yeah. Share with us your thoughts on interviewing. What have you found to be more effective? How do you advise some of your counterparts or maybe some of your clients or other staffing firms when it comes to really, you know, increasing your batting average as far as the interview goes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the beliefs that's important to share that goes into how I interview, especially in the work that I do, right? So I have about 150 recruiters and staff members. So it's, we'll say, a mid-sized organization. It's big enough that goal-oriented leadership and delegation is important, right? I can't keep track and stay on top of all that. So some philosophical and cultural alignment is part of the management strategy. Cultural alignment is not a given. I also think that a lot of the concrete skills that somebody has, like the things in their brain, those are valuable, but those are changeable, right? Like I can put new concrete things into somebody's brain if they don't have them. What's harder is to find people that flourish in the environment that I create, the kind of culture I create, and the type of leader that I am. So I interview heavily for culture fit. And I also give them, and you had mentioned this, as much information as I can so that they can opt out on the basis of culture fit, right? Because I don't take it personally if somebody's like, well, I don't want to work in an environment like that. That's okay, right? Like there are environments I don't want to work in, but that doesn't make them bad. And so the two things that are very, very important to me are learning agility. And I interview a lot for learning agility and the way that somebody approaches learning. And it includes like, you know, how do you view competitions over ideas, right? Like, are you able to emotionally distance yourself from an idea, defend it, and then deny it if you think that it fails the test? Or do you get wedded to your idea? Like, do you fall in love with it because it's your baby and you created it? You know, somebody that falls in love with ideas probably won't love working with me because I'm willing to abandon ideas as soon as I'm persuaded that it's bad. And so that kind of learning agility is important. And then the second thing is, you know, and you can sort of blend this with, to a degree, humility. I don't tend to talk about it that way, but just thinking now, maybe what it is I like people that are able to be articulate and thoughtful about where they've screwed stuff up. Right? Like, and if you're not comfortable with that language, you're not going to be comfortable with me, because I tend to use polarizing language. And look, failures are failures, but failures aren't bad to me. Right? Failures are, this is what happened when we did the best that we could and it didn't work out. And let's learn what went wrong or what we would do differently next time. And so lightheartedly, I often share where, like, I've really messed stuff up. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, if you're interviewing with me, where have you messed stuff up? Right? The idea that at 28, when you got your first, you know, big step up, you did it all right, is insane. So what did you learn when you did that first big step up and you screwed some stuff up? And that tells me a lot about, again, how they view humility, if they're able to be reflective about their own imperfections, the way that they articulate progress over time, and then their comfort with what for some people comes across as challenging language, right? Calling something a failure. If you're comfortable calling it that, but understanding that doesn't mean I don't support you, I still do. And it doesn't mean that I don't trust and still delegate to you, I still do. I just want to know that you've got that evolutionary mindset as you lead and manage a group for me.
I love your thoughts on failure and mistakes as, you know, framework for really understanding. It's an opportunity to learn, right? Yeah. And I've seen some very successful startups and other companies where they really instill that type as part of their culture.
Yeah.
Where, you know, when everything is great, is great. But when things go sideways, that's really when the true colors come out from the leadership perspective.
Yeah.
And instead of treating that, oh my God, this is a failure and, you know, we're so screwed. If you build that foundation right at the beginning, then all of the mistakes or all of those challenges really become, okay, great. We're in this situation. It's an opportunity to learn. What do we get out of this? And how do we move forward? I think that goes hand in hand with exactly what you're talking about as part of, you know, making that analysis when you interview potential candidates. Will they fit that right environment, especially when it's so dynamic and things change by the hour? Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting thoughts on that. From your personal kind of view in terms of self-education, your content diet, What are some of the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself educated ahead of the curve with everything that's, you know, with so much information overload being thrown at us, how selective are you with what you let your mind be exposed to?
Yeah. So that's interesting. So on some levels, I'm extremely selective and I'll share what's right for me. I'm not selling this to somebody else. I find emotional management pretty important for me because I need to be emotionally available for my staff and my organization. And so if I've got stuff coming into my head that, you know, makes me believe that, you know, everything is terrible or the world's falling apart, I can't be helpful to anybody. So I am very selective and limited with like the news, right? Like maybe that doesn't surprise anybody, but like, I don't try and consume a lot of it because, you know, these days, at least in my estimation, the news is sort of oriented towards a fairly small set of goals to make you sad or angry or outraged, right? And like, if they can get you into one of those emotional states, they feel like they won. And those are emotional states that I just don't perform well in. So, you know, I'm very selective on that front. Now, that said, I do consume a fair bit of content. I consume a lot of YouTube. Probably other people do too. I'm amazed at the quality of content and the level of thought that you can find. And, you know, there's some stuff, for example, there's a guy named Lex Fridman, who does a lot of sort of contemporary conversations, but he's an AI scientist at MIT. And that's just an intersection that I really enjoy. And he's got a very, human, lens on AI and the relationship that we have with technology, and being in the HRTA space, that's a lens I can really relate to. So I do listen to a fair bit of YouTube, and like Lex is a good example of like the kind of YouTube. And then I try and always have something that I'm reading that in some way is helping me out. So I think slow format content is also important. I learn differently when I read than when I listen. And so, you know, a book, for example, Rational Choice in an Uncertain World. And it's some of the academic work by a professor and named Daniel Kahneman. And he does some really interesting stuff on decision theory and decision making, which for me, when I'm designing software and trying to design experiences for recruiters in technical systems, being able to apply some of the research on how they think and make decisions helps me write better software.
That's a great recommendation. I'm pretty sure you've either read or it's on your radar, the Thinking Fast and Slow, yeah, by him, which is a very fascinating read. I relate to that on, you know, almost on a daily basis with how decision-making basically is processed. To go to, you know, the other side of the spectrum, at the beginning, you've mentioned as part of the business model for job.com is through mergers and acquisitions of the mid-sized staffing firms. So when I hear that, it brings a lot of memories when I was part of the Fortune 500 companies and we would acquire an organization, and it's a process and it's also a challenge when it comes to integration, not only from the system perspective, which I think is relatively simple when it comes to the people integration and making the part of the culture. Share some thoughts with us from that perspective. How do you succeed in that space? What are some of the frameworks and strategies that really help you smooth out that transition and making sure that it really does not impact the culture at large?
Yeah. So here's a no-brainer, but I'll mention it for the avoidance of doubt. Your M&A and integration strategy has to match what you're buying, right? The kind of firm that you're buying. And so for example, within the human capital space, when we're buying a staffing firm or a recruiting firm, there's no manufacturing line that we're buying. There's no raw material in a closet, right? No bars of gold somewhere. There's no widget that they're selling, right? You're buying, and it's more solid than this, but, you know, lightheartedly, I'll say you're buying sort of an ineffable agreement of a group of people to do things in a certain way under a brand together at a certain price point and sales value communication strategy, right? Like, it's mushy, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you have a, if you have an integration strategy that doesn't put people and culture first, that's probably the wrong strategy for buying those kinds of businesses, right? Which doesn't mean it's the wrong strategy. It just doesn't apply to this, right? So the first is make sure that your strategy matches the business that you're buying. Now, the businesses that I'm buying are, as I described, these human capital organizations. given that I spend an extraordinary amount of time in the first probably 90 to 120 days just listening and learning, right? Like, how do you describe things? How do you think about your business? How do you sell or not sell? At what point do you stop pushing a sale? When do you walk away from a deal? Like, how do your employees describe their jobs to their spouses and their friends? Like, all of these cultural truths, they're not right or wrong. I want to know how they describe them, right? And then I've got a set of things that I want to accomplish. Let's imagine there's five different things that I want to accomplish. Well, I don't need to accomplish all five, and I don't need to prioritize the sequence one through five necessarily. And so as I'm getting to know the company, I'm going to start matching natural inertia in the business and natural beliefs in the business to these five goals, right? And that allows me to then come alongside the acquisition and set targets together and have the acquisition experience be much more collaborative and much less sort of here, I'm going to tell you now how to think about things, which just, you know, sort of destroys morale and self-confidence and culture, which you can't afford to do if that's sort of what you're buying is morale, self-confidence and culture.
Right. Absolutely. And as you spend a lot of time, you know, with prospect companies, with a lot of the staffing firms, mm-hmm. Looking into Steve O'Brien's personal crystal ball in terms of the evolution of the role of the staffing company moving yeah. forward, where do you see the staffing companies evolve to, or maybe you wish the staffing industry and the staffing companies will you know, mold or evolve into? What are some of the thoughts around there?
Yeah. So some of this will probably be intuitive to listeners. And so I recognize I'm not the first to say this, but, you know, on the perm placement side, there's continuous pressure as internal TA functions get more and more effective and technology enables them to be more and more effective. And so on the perm placement side, we're looking to do a lot more culture and assessment work to be able to describe at a higher level what fit means. Right. And what does it mean to be successful in your organization? Because if you're going to pay 25% to 35%, the days of we do that just because it's hard to find this talent, they're sort of numbered in a sense, right? So on the perm side, where are the areas that we're going to add value? On the contract side, we're working very hard to begin building and bringing together employee experiences that are not wholly distinct if you're a contractor or a full-time employee, right? And some organizations refer to this as total talent. Some people refer to it just as being decent to talent acquisition, right? But at the end of the day, whether you have a contractor badge or an FTE badge, your employee value proposition really shouldn't be that different, right? And so partnering with companies to bring those experiences together. And then on the RPO side or the recruitment process outsourcing side, for probably the last, as long as 3 years, but it really became unavoidably obvious in the last 2 years, RPO is not only a recruitment process outsourcing now, but it is a adjacent partner to internal TA capabilities, doing projects and augmenting internal competencies, right? And so in the businesses that I run now, and in a lot that I'm looking at, the amount of project and supplementary strategic partnership work, as opposed to whole outsourcing that's going on, is higher than I've ever seen it. And I've been doing this for an RPO over 15 years.
So with the you have a decent sized team under you. You've mentioned between 100 and 150 folks, I believe. And with integration and the continuous need for that improvement and innovation cycles, there's got to be a, you know, one of the top players is building and fostering that culture of innovation at your organization. What are some of the strategies and practical recommendations that you can provide when it comes to really building and fostering that environment for people to continuously innovate, experiment, and look at ways to do things better?
Yeah. So I guess I'll give you three ideas. And the first one begins with a belief I have, and certainly something I try and instill culturally, is that innovation is not self-justifying, right? Like we sometimes talk about innovation, like go innovate. As if it's like self-justifying, like love your child, right? Like love your child is self-justifying. Yes, do that, right? Innovation is not love your child. You're trying to accomplish something, right? You're trying to build a capability for somebody that they don't have now, or you're trying to remove friction in a process that currently is there, right? So make sure that when you talk about innovation, you know, not that we want to innovate, but that we want to do something else. And innovation is going to help facilitate that. So that's the first thing, is innovate by letting go of the idea that innovation is just self-justifying. And then the second thing is provide time and space for real discovery and experimentation to occur, right? If you want innovation to be a part of your culture, you have to not be operating on the lowest rungs of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like, and that's a bit of an analogy, but like if everybody is concerned about scarcity and safety and trying to not have to work 65 hours again this week, you know, when they're, you know, where their mind is, their mind is in fight or flight, right? Their mind is not in like empathizing and laterally thinking about how can we do something better. It's about self-protection. And so don't go to a company or a group of folks and say, well, on top of working 65 hours a week, I want you to think laterally and non-linearly and empathetically, right? Like it's not going to happen. And then the third thing is, in addition to having a functional goal, there needs to be some kind of economic relief, right? Because again, like it's not self-justifying. So in what way can we figure out how to pull a business case together so that this makes sense? And how do we make sure that all of our staff that are involved in this innovative exploration understand that like we, Job.com is not a nonprofit. And most of the companies that we work for are not nonprofits. And so we've also got to figure out whether we're private or public, our investors or our board, like somebody's looking for evidence of progress and then a return, right? And so, you know, innovation doesn't mean I need to find a way to increase margins by 5%, but there needs to be some economic discipline that also is tied to this investment in time and technology that drives what ultimately becomes the headline, you know, Job.com innovates, right?
I love those three categories that you had defined from the innovation standpoint. As when I interviewed a CTO of L'Oreal, he mentioned something that goes within the lines of necessity is the mother of invention.
Yep.
Where at the end of the day, looking at innovation, not necessarily something that's grandiose and transformational and disruptive, it could be a very small improvement to internal process or yep. just even how you operate as an individual. I think a lot of that goes within the framework of really fostering such environment, which exactly what you're talking about. When it comes to best career advice or series of advice that you had received throughout your career that you continuously refer back to, share with us some of those that really, you know, that you provide on an ongoing basis to some of the people that you mentor.
Yeah. One piece of career advice is get really, really good at something, right? Like in the early stages of your career, be excellent and invest the time to be excellent and don't rush out of that stage of your career. You know, sometimes when I'm talking with folks that are at that stage or they're recently starting to consider they want to become a manager, for many of us, when we close the book on that chapter of our career, it's closed, right? And those stories then are fixed. Now, if you have a really great library full of stories and experiences and things that you can tell, not only can you tell as a leader more credible, relatable stories about those that are doing the work or to those that are doing the work, you also have a better toolkit to empathize with. You've been in the trench longer, right? Like, you know what it's like. You're not going to be as much of an ivory tower bonehead if you spent the time getting really, really good at something. The second thing is, and this is an iterative process, keep trying to think less about yourself. It's not easy. I don't know that any of it, like I've not gotten there, right? But like, I do know that like, if I keep flexing that muscle over time, I get better at it. And we flip back and forth between scarcity and surplus, right? In our lives and in our careers, but like keep trying to like flip towards giving and thinking about other people. Because ultimately what ends up happening is you become, and I say this word in quotes, you become more powerful, right? The reason that you're more powerful is people trust you. Right? Like, you're able to deploy more mind share more rapidly. You're able to deploy more cooperation more rapidly. And that makes you a better leader over time. And then I think the last thing is, and this is a weird piece of career advice. Be prepared as your career grows, or at least in my experience, to have periods of time where you're really working to make yourself irrelevant, right? Like, You get to a stage where like the best thing that you can do for an organization is disappear. You know, get very quiet, give space to other people, let other people have the win, let other people have the spotlight, be quiet and be patient. And like, I've had periods where like, you know, my wife observes, you know, what I'm doing at work. And she's like, do you do anything? You know, and like, I do. And right now I'm working very hard to be quiet. you know, to give others space. I guess those are three different thoughts that are, you know, at least true for my career.
The last one especially definitely stands out, and it goes hand in hand with something that I definitely truly believe in when it comes to leadership. Is your job as a leader is to make yourself obsolete. Mm-hmm. If you can create an environment where others are successful on their own, they don't need that hierarchy, they don't need that decision making, you know, priority or abilities for you to make something, you know, on their behalf. Yep. I think that's powerful. I think that's a great characteristic of exceptional leaders who are able to take a step back and completely to the sidelines and let the team flourish. I think that's super powerful. In terms of, to the extent that you can share, what's next for job.com? Where are you taking the company? Where would you like to be?
Yeah. So there are some near-term things that we're working very hard towards, and that is to more deeply integrate our technology into the firms that we acquire so that we can provide better experiences for recruiters, candidates, and clients, and so that we can start being able to demonstrate that the software that we design, in fact, makes things better, right, at the experiential level, at the outcomes level, and at the recruiter productivity level. And then as we demonstrate that is true, job.com is ultimately targeting being a public organization. Figuring out that roadmap and timeline to make sure that we do the best we can for our existing investors, that we time that to raise the right amount of capital for our continued roadmap and development. And that, you know, we move quickly, but we don't rush, right? And just finding that sweet spot. And then the third thing that is, on the map is continuing to, especially for me, identify great mid-sized staffing firms. There's probably, and this is something that I just personally get out of doing this job. There's not much more enjoyable to me than meeting entrepreneurs that have built great companies, finding ways to bring together their forces with my force, and then building a bigger, amazing human capital organization. That's just a ton of fun. So that's on the menu as well.
Yeah, that definitely does sound like a ton of fun, because for me, a space for, you know, I've been an angel investor in technology startups for a while now as a former, you know, founder operator, and just the whole venture capital space and how the whole ecosystem works in the sense of being able to identify those unique talents and help them scale, grow together, win together. I think that's, you know, that's a lot of fun. So I'm definitely, it's a little bit of jealousy there in terms of what kind of you deal with day to day. Absolutely. You've mentioned Daniel Kahneman. Is there another book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
So I love the research that Adam Grant does. He wrote, so the first book that I read of his that really did just change my life and fed some of the perspective I shared earlier about trying to click into putting others first is the book Give and Take. The idea, and like part of this is also because of my personality. Like I'm not a typical like type A, like in your face, negotiate to win type of a guy. I am what I would like to think strategic. I am looking to negotiate good deals, I would not be cast for a role on the sitcom Suits, right? Like that's just not me. And looking for research and thinkers that can help me understand the way that I establish influence and drive great deals, given my personality. So I think Adam Grant's research is phenomenal and interesting. In my opinion, a very livable and human way to be extremely competitive, because I'm not advocating be uncompetitive. I'm just advocating be it in a way that you're comfortable with, right? That you're good with at the end of the day. So Adam Grant's another one. And then I wanted to mention to the listeners one other book that had an unusual effect on me, the Count of Monte Cristo, all 1500 pages of it, right? Like if you can find your way through it, the Count of Monte Cristo really transformed my point of view. And I get that it's fiction. I know that anybody's like, it's a story. I get it. But long-term planning, right? Just weaving together deep strategies, right? Deep plans, and having them not only operate in the short term and having some like near-term off-ramps, but also just some deep stuff you've built into what you're doing that if it works and it matures to that point, right? You look like a genius. Right? Like how long ago did you start planning this? Like 7 years, you know what I mean? Like yeah. That kind of stuff is just really cool as well. And that affected me dramatically.
No, I love those recommendations. Definitely going to make those available in the show notes. And, you know, a favorite saying is that nothing is ever short term. Yeah. That whatever in life and work and whatever the case may be, everything great is always long term. So yeah, I think that resonates with the book that you the kind of the premise behind that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Steve, last but not least, what's the kindest thing someone has ever done to you?
Let's see here.
No, it's a loaded one, and I love to throw that curveball at the end of every episode because it speaks a lot to in terms of how you operate, who you surround yourself with. So absolutely.
So I'll give you a couple quick ones that are in different sort of domains of life. So October 15th will be my 15th wedding anniversary, and one of the kindest things somebody's ever done to me is my wife staying married to me. I am not a perfect man. and she is the mother of two children and is really just a saint and incredible support and forgiving beyond measure with all of my faults and foibles and that kind of stuff. And lighthearted and good spirited about it as well. So like, for example, the other day, my son who's six, he was grumbling about not having much free time on weeknights because he's got activities in school. And I said, well, you know, does dad have much free time? You know, I have to work. He's like, no, you don't have. And I had said, does your mom have much free time? Which the correct answer is no. And he's like, yeah, she has a ton. and she doesn't hit the eject button. The second is when I was in college, I found college very hard. I know many of us do. And I did an undergraduate degree that required a lot of reading and writing, and that's just time consuming. And there was a period of time where I was, down and out, and maybe clinically down and out. And a friend threw a surprise birthday party for me. And that was just the right thing at the right moment. And it left a memory with me to today, over 20 years later, that just, you know, that kind of kindness and that kind of reminder that like there are people in my life that love me and care about me, that made a pretty big difference. And then the final one is professional. I've had folks be willing to report to me and not destroy my organization that probably should have been my boss, right? That showed me the kind of humility that I hope to show to other people, that we're in a role to do a job and that we just kind of got to click in and find a way, and not everything can always be about ourselves. There was a guy when I was at IBM that reported to me that really probably should have had my job, but he didn't. And instead of using that to undermine our relationship and my team, he just said, how can I help? And that kind of selflessness in the context of a company or an organization trying to accomplish something, I see that as incredible kindness for folks just to say, you know what, I'm not going to scratch the itch of making sure Steve knows that I could be his boss.
I love that. Definitely great stories when it comes to kindness. So definitely thank you for sharing that. And just overall, Steve, I enjoyed this conversation. Very, very short, but fast paced and insightful. I personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with all the guests on Ivy Podcast and do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago, listen to that and see if everything that we've talked about still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Likewise. It's been a pleasure, John. This is awesome. I look forward to the follow-up.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.